Our last speaker for this symposium is Dr. Ellen Davis. Dr. Davis earned her PhD at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville. She currently serves as the swine research manager for Danisco, where she performs research to develop and determine mode of action of novel direct-fed microbials. She also manages an immunology and cell culture laboratory that investigates immunological modes of action of direct-fed and microbial candidate organisms and bacterial components. Dr. Davis.
Thanks, Jeff, for that introduction, and thank you to the organizing committee for inviting me to present at this symposium, although they may be wondering what they were thinking when they see that the vast majority of the data that I'm going to be presenting is going to be in pigs. But with that, I will recognize the co-author on my presentation, Tom Rayberger. He and a group of other scientists are responsible for the dairy milk production data that you're going to see today. So before you run out, there will be some dairy focus to this presentation as well. So just to get started, I'll go through a little outline of the presentation, kind of where we're going to be going today. I'm going to start off with an introduction on the importance of the gastrointestinal microbiota and immune development, and then also how that relates to performance, just so we can kind of get our mindset with what our focus is when we're looking at livestock. And then I'm going to show some data on direct-fed microbial application in neonatal development, and then move to also GFM application in later stages of production. So we're going to look at two different applications with two different focuses here. One, to really alter early development in the young animal. And then second, in an adult animal, when you administer direct-fed microbial, can you really alter production parameters that might be of interest? And then hopefully when we're done with this, the data shown here, you'll see really, hopefully the importance of strategic selection of the microorganisms that go into the direct-fed microbials, and also the applications of that into the livestock species. So if you were here earlier, at the earlier part of this symposium, you've seen this before, but I'm going to use this to really demonstrate that we have this just group of bacteria, feed antigens, everything really in the lumen of the gastrointestinal tract. And the immune system at the level of the gastrointestinal tract really is set up to control sampling and exposure of those components in the lumen into that whole immune response. And here I'm showing a little subsection here at the Peyer's patch. And this is one of the lymphoid structures in the intestine set up to really a controlled sampling of that gastrointestinal luminal contents. And that through the M cell, where it can actually reach in and sample bacteria, feed antigens, any component there in the lumen of the gastrointestinal tract, and then the immune system is going to respond to that. It doesn't care if it's a commensal or beneficial bacteria, if it's a pathogen, or if it's a probiotic that we've added. The immune system is going to respond to that additive into the lumen in some manner. And then it really sets up a balance between pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory responses to really maintain an immune homeostasis at the level of the gastrointestinal tract. And where problems arise really is when that controlled sampling is suddenly uncontrolled. So here we're showing the top of the villus here in this little section of the epithelial cell layer at the top of the villus. And when disruptions happen that cause a leaky barrier function here at the level of the gastrointestinal tract, and these luminal antigens, bacterial pathogens, commensal bacteria, or dietary antigens can then start coming through that disrupted barrier, we end up with really a dysregulated immune response. So it may be a pro-inflammatory response or over-exuberant inflammatory response at the expense of the anti-inflammatory control. And then this is really where you end up with some just dysregulation there at the level of the gastrointestinal tract. So really what we're after is immune homeostasis in the gastrointestinal tract. And really, if you think about the immune system, it's really not, someone made a comment that if the immune system was there to combat pathogens, we'd really be in trouble because it's doing a horrible job. Because the pathogens are present there in the gastrointestinal tract, and the immune system has really set up mechanisms to set itself up to maintain homeostasis there, not fight a battle constantly. So make sure it can fight a battle when it needs to fight a battle, but then really to be able to set up and be more controlled or less reactive when it's not needed. And then relating this to animal performance, this is some data that that I did in collaboration with the University of Arkansas, Dr. Charlie Maxwell's lab, looking at immune cell populations in the jejunum intraepithelial lymphocyte population. These are phenotypes using flow cytometry that were positively correlated to pig body weight at 11 days post-weaning. So we sampled pigs post-weaning, looked at immune cell phenotypes, the level of the gastrointestinal tract, had animal performance data associated with that, and here are the immune cell profiles that were positively correlated statistically to high pig body weight at 11 days post-weaning. And you're seeing gamma delta T cell phenotypes here, double gamma delta CD8s, some of the double positive phenotypes that are present there in the level of the gastrointestinal tract, all of these, and also the CD25, which is an interleukin-2 receptor on T-cell cell surfaces. And all of these were positively correlated to pig body weight. This is just a graphic schematic with a redundancy analysis similar to a principal component analysis with the weight at 11 days shown here in the red arrow. Some of the populations, the length of the arrow is the strength of the correlation. So if it's going in the same way as the weight, then these were strongly correlated to pig weight. So the immune system at the level of the gastrointestinal tract and also systemically is really related to pig body weight or any of our animal performance measurements. So when we set up, when we think about what we're going to look at when we're looking at microbial populations, immune response, we're looking at really our animal performance in the livestock area is really what we're focusing on. But we can use DNA isolation techniques. You're going to see in this talk use of TRFLP to look at community analysis of microbial populations of the gastrointestinal tract. And then blood and tissue, primarily focusing on the gastrointestinal tract of immune cells from these tissues. And then looking at immunology, mainly flow cytometry cell phenotypes, to really look at correlations of bacterial species performance and immune factors. And what that's going to allow us to do is to use these molecular approaches then to, in combination with our natural animal models, to identify the important microbial contributors that are going to benefit animal production. So the first bit of data, we'll get through the pig data first, and then we'll go to the dairy, is looking at DFM administration and neonatal development. And this is a study that we did looking at a combination of two bacillus strains that were selected for their ability to inhibit Clostridia in the neonatal pig. And this DFM was administered to 208 mixed parity sows that were housed in a commercial swine research farm. So the sow diets were essentially a control standard corn soy diet, and then the DFM was administered to that control diet at 3.75 times 10 to the 5th CFUs per gram of feed. It was fed for 6 weeks prior to parturition and also throughout lactation. And we sampled 21 pigs from each sow treatment group on day 3 of lactation and then 15 pigs on day 10 of lactation from each one of those treatment groups and looked at ileum and colon samples. So that's kind of set up for the data that you're going to see. To go ahead and get this out of the way, because I know it's a question, so we can go ahead and focus on the fun, mode of action type stuff. Yes, we did improve litter performance with the direct-fed microbial supplementation to the sow. So from a standardized litter size here of close to 11 pigs, this is our standard. We standardized litter size between the two, the DFM and the control. Looking at initial litter weight of the pigs from the DFM, they actually were higher, had a higher DFM supplemented sows, had a higher initial litter weight of pigs than did the control. If you looked at this on an individual pig body weight, it looked like we improved pig body weight a little bit with the DFM supplementation that's 6 weeks prior to parturition. This was maintained at weaning weight, significantly higher litter weight as you'd expect with a higher birth weight. But we also did improve litter average daily gain slightly here with a tendency there. So we're getting a little bit of improvement throughout the lactation period as well. And then a tendency to improve litter size and to decrease pre-weaning mortality, although mortality really was pretty good in the study. So what this is showing is TRF peaks here that we found in the gastrointestinal tract, and this is looking at the administration of this DFM to the sow and how it shifts the intestinal microbiota in the pig towards specific lactobacillus populations. So these are those three-day-old piglets in the colon that we saw here that we talked about sampling. So these pigs are 3 days of age. And what you're seeing here, I don't want you to think that when you see the DFM, these are the only microbial species that were present in the colon of these pigs. what you're seeing here is kind of a subtraction. So any of these that are listed, these TRF peaks that are indicative of a sequence of the bacterial DNA that was present in the gastrointestinal tract, these listed were positively correlated to being present in a DFM compared to the control pigs. If you see it under the control pigs, these were the organisms that would have been present most often in the control compared to the DFM. So they've got a whole huge number of TRFs that are common to both of these. So they've got a total microbiota. These are the ones that are different. And it's nice when you run these trials and your premise ends up coming out to be statistically significant, because you can see a lot of the putative identifications of the TRF peaks in those controls, peaks from the control cells were Clostridia, E. coli, Clostridium, several other things. This again is putative identification based on a database. It's not sequenced. But most likely these things keep coming up. Probably it may not be this Clostridium species specifically, but general Clostridium indicated on that TRF. And we selected our DFM to inhibit those. None of those are associated with the DFM, and they're only associated with control. But what's really interesting is what ended up coming up with the DFM. So when the sow was supplemented with the DFM, the microbiota of her pig at 3 days of age, that seemed to be most likely and how it differed from the control pigs, was this Lactobacillus gastrinae johnsonii. And that came up in the three different enzymes that we used in the serotherapy analysis. Look at day 10 in the colon. And interestingly now, at 10 days of age, here's our microbiota differences in the DFM, pigs from the DFM supplement in sows. Again, here's our Lactobacillus gastrinae johnsonii coming up again, still at day 10 in the colon. And really a whole lot of candidates here that you'd use for a probiotic. So just by administering a bacillus-based DFM to the sow, we've altered the microbial composition and development in her offspring. And then again, really not much that was present in the control that really wasn't in the TFM. And this is just a visual representation of that Lactobacillus gastrinae johnsonii using a Kanoko analysis, again, a redundancy analysis, sort of a principal component analysis, with the red arrow here, the DFM versus the control. And again, the length of the arrow is the strength of the correlation, and this peak indicative of the Lactobacillus gastrinae johnsonii strongly correlated to the DFM treatment. And this is some new data that really is, we're just starting to put together, but we also took colostrum samples from the sows within 24 hours of birth of her pigs and looked at immune cell phenotypes within the colostrum. And the premise being is in the livestock species, of course, we have the colostrum is very important for passive transfer of immunoglobulins into neonate circulation. But there's really a large population of immune cells, whole cells in that colostrum. And so you have to wonder if the immunoglobulins are getting to that pig systemically, why aren't some of those immune cells getting in there as well? And could really this be the first immune function of that neonatal pig, since the pig is born completely immuno-naive. So what we looked at, really focusing on the myeloid cell subset, looking at MHC2 population overall, and then we took a subset of that population. So here at the top you're seeing the immune cell populations from control cells versus the Bacillus DFM cells here. And we gated essentially the MHC2, this is a fluorescent antibody that detects that on the cell surface of the cells. And you're looking at forward scatter here on the x-axis, which as we heard before is the size of the cell going across on the x. And on the y would be the fluorescent, positive fluorescent tag for MHC2. So we've gated essentially the MHC2 populations, which really didn't differ between the control and the bacillus supplemented cells. We had about a 90% of the immune cells that were present in the colostrum were MHC2 positive. So we gate those and then ask what proportion of this total MHC2 population has swine workshop cluster 9 positive cell surface marker or a swine workshop cluster 3. Both of these are indicative of a myeloid cell lineage, which essentially is a macrophage dendritic cell type cell. The swine workshop cluster 3 being more of a monocyte or a non-differentiated or non-activated type of myeloid cell lineage, and swine workshop cluster 9 being more of an activated or a tissue macrophage. And what we saw here is we had a significant difference in the proportion of these activated macrophages within the MHC2 population compared to those control cells. So we've even, by administering the DFM to the cell, changed the immune cell profile of the immune cells in colostrum of that cell. And then what was really interesting is we also, remember, took a blood sample and a gastrointestinal sample from those piglets at 3 days of age. And we looked at the same immune cell phenotype in the systemic circulation of that pig at 3 days of age. This is from the peripheral blood mononuclear cell population from those piglets. So, okay, the major histocompatibility complex to our MHC2 population is not as large in the systemic circulation because there are probably other cells there competing for that percentage or proportion. It looks actually rather large, but the significance wasn't there. But if you look at that same within this MHC2 population, Swine Workshop Cluster 9 and Swine Workshop Cluster 3, we're again seeing the very same pattern and very close to the same percentages, with that are different between the pigs from sows fed that bacillus and the control, and it's the same proportion that you saw in the colostrum of that sow. So it's not a direct link. Do I know that these were the cells that came out of colostrum and then ended up in the piglets? No, I don't know that. But it's kind of an interesting bit of data that we've got coming out of there. So just in summary of this data, so we've got a bacillus-based DFM application that was administered to the sow, and we're looking at immune effects in the sow and in the pig, and these actually were related when we had the bacillus supplementation to the sow. Now, we know we had microbial changes at the piglet level from administration of the bacillus DFM to the sow. It's really questionable what we've done to the microbial population of that sow. It's really kind of a nightmare. Nobody likes to sacrifice their sows to let me get gastrointestinal samples and look at microbial populations. And when we're looking at ileum and colon, or particularly the upper part of the colon, I don't believe fecal samples are going to give you a good measurement. I've tried, I've looked, and it even pathogenic organisms is questionable. Depending upon when you take that fecal sample, how good your data is. So that's really a big question mark right there, is really what's our mode of action? How are we impacting microbial development in this piglet? And we're also impacting, I didn't show this data, but we've got immune cell phenotypes in these piglets at 3 days of age and 10 days of age that are affected as well. Are we controlling the pathogenic transfer of those pathogenic organisms from the sow to the piglet by showing that the treated or pigs from the treated sow don't have a lot of the Clostridium populations that the controls do? And is that really the impetus of opening up a niche in the environment, in the microbial environment, in the intestinal environment for those lactobacillus populations to be in those pigs from the treated sow? I mean, there's really a big box, a question mark, how we kind of got there. But the data is certainly encouraging. So we'll use the milk, sow milk data as a segue into some work that was done looking at the DFM applications to dairy cows to increase milk production. And the premise here for the selection of this direct fed microbial was the metabolic effects of propionate. So propionate, of course, is a major precursor for gluconeogenesis, and ruminal propionate can really go through gluconeogenesis process. In theory, it should increase glucose, and then also therefore provide more substrate for lactose supply. So by increasing ruminal propionate production, we hope you'd increase gluconeogenesis, increase plasma insulin, increase plasma leptin, increase feed efficiency, milk production, and maybe even reproductive efficiency. So this was the whole premise when you're thinking about what could be the production ramifications by increasing propionate in the rumen. So to get to a direct-fed microbial, what was done was propionate bacteria were isolated and characterized from the rumen of dairy cows. And these certain strains were selected that were capable of producing high levels of propionate after typical conditions in a rumen of a lactating dairy cow. So what we ended up with finally after the selection was propionate bacterium strain P169 was who came out of the whole selection process of all the propionate bacterium in the rumen. And when we administered this strain to dairy cattle, and this work is published by Stein, and this is some work done by Dr. Leon Spicer's group at Oklahoma State in collaboration with Tom Rayberger and some other scientists. And it's always nice, again, when you had a premise of of this propionic bacterium that's going to increase propionate in the rumen, and luckily it does at the high dose. No difference in the low dose and the control. Our doses were a 6 times 10 to the 10 CFUs and a 6 times 10 to the 11 CFUs per day per cal. So that's your difference, a lot of difference here between your low and your high dose. And also decreased acetate to propionate ratio. So all the things that we hoped we'd see by adding the propion, the P169 to the cal. If you look at the effects of P169 on fat-corrected milk, and this is looking at multiparous cows and also primiparous cows, the response is really strong and really clear here in the multiparous cows. You can see that the high dose and the low dose, though a little bit inconsistently, increased a fat-corrected milk compared to the control here on the bottom. And then if you look at primiparous, the response isn't quite as strong, but still our high dose, low dose are up above the control cows. And then looking at milk lactase, lactose with P169 administration, high and low dose increase in milk lactose in the multiparous cow. Again, that response quite as strong in the primiparous. But if you look at cow body weight, and this is through this all this data is through the 25 weeks of lactation from feeding P169. High dose here and also the low dose of P169 increase. This is all, this is body weight relative to week one body weight. So we're really looking at how quickly the cow's body weight recovers, after the first week of lactation, or through lactation here. And we have an increase in the cow body weight then over the 25 weeks of lactation, relative to that week one in the high and the low dose compared to control. In primiparous, what was interesting is it's actually flipped. And that is a little worrisome. But then if you think about the very different metabolic structure this primiparous cow is probably in, and we got an increase in milk production, although not as strong as in the multiparous, from feeding it to the primiparous cow, she also probably isn't going to recover her body weight as quickly just because of the stage she is in her early life. So she still has an energy requirement for growth. So we actually increased her milk production with P169, and now she's got even more of an energy drag then to recover from for the body weight. But if you look in, this is overall both multiparous and the primiparous cows. If you look at feed consumption over the weeks in lactation relative to kilograms of body weight, you really don't see any difference in feed intake in these cows. So and a suggestion that we're improving efficiency of milk production without really increasing the feed intake or the input that would go into that. And then some interesting data from a different publication was to really look at some of the metabolic effects systemically and in the milk as well. So we want to look at plasma insulin, and this was a separate study looking at control cows. This is a yeast supplement, and this is P169 with the yeast supplement. So we're essentially looking at the effects of P169 with in the context really of a yeast supplement in the diet compared to control with no yeast. When P169 and the yeast were fed, plasma insulin did increase in, these are the hours after, post-feeding here on the x-axis. The yeast, some spikes of it lower than the P169 and the yeast. The P169 is having an effect over yeast than the control here at the bottom. So you think, okay, that should show glucose should show a response relative to the plasma insulin response. Plasma glucose really doesn't show a response here. And what we think really is the timing of taking that blood sample. We may be missing some of the changes. So just relative to these points here going up and down and the variation there, just doesn't seem that the plasma glucose is really that clear. But when you look at milk glucose, which was taken at week one and week two twice, it was taken at the PM milking every of those days across week one and week two. And this is showing in the black box the week one measurement and the week two measurement in the stripe. As you see, P169 actually did increase milk glucose. So we're thinking that was more of a sink for the glucose and probably a better way to measure, you know, the glucose response to P169 maybe than the plasma glucose that really just seemed to be very variable. So just to sum that up, what we have, back to the premise of our metabolic effects of increased propionate in the rumen, is when we add P169 to dairy cattle, and this goes back to the list of things that we had in the initial slide for this study, what we actually showed with data was we did increased ruminal propionate, increased insulin, increased milk production, increased milk lactose and milk glucose, and although I didn't show the feed efficiency response, the feed intake data really was no different between any of the treatments. So really to conclude and get to the end, I'm going to leave you with a thought here that when we start to think about applying direct-fed microbials to livestock, and really even more so when we think about selecting direct-fed microbials for specific jobs we want them to do to enhance specific measurements in our livestock production, regardless of the species, we really have to think that our microbial consortia really have distinct personalities. The individuals in the microbial consortia have distinct personalities. And you can say that's even within a bacterial species. So some data that we've done in the cell culture lab at the Waukesha site with some strains of Lactobacillus plantarum and Lactobacillus acidophilus. So you're looking at three strains of Lactobacillus plantarum. These are rapid profiles, which is pretty much the genotype of differences in genotype between the three strains of Lactobacillus plantarum and the three strains of Lactobacillus acidophilus. And you can even see some of these, generally the Lactobacillus acidophilus, have very similar genetic profiles. But when you look at these, and what we show here, in the blue box would be the Lactobacillus strains, and the dark blue would be the L. plantarum, is we're looking at fold change in gene expression of a macrophage inflammatory protein 2, or MIP2, in IEC6 cells. And these are rat intestinal epithelial cell lines that we're looking at here in response to these bacteria. Is you see that in when they're this is fold change unstimulated and the response to of these bacteria in unstimulated culture, is you see even just the unstimulated fold change of MIP2 is very different between these individual strains. We have it upregulated here for LA11, it's downregulated for NCFM, and downregulated for LA1. And then you go in and challenge with LPS. And this is LPS alone and then LPS with the individual strains. So you see also their response to the inflammatory stimuli are also very different. So think about even just these three different strains of Lactobacillus, Acidophilus, and the three different plantarums in our cell culture system and how very different they are. And then you think about the multiple bacterial species that are in our guts. They really all are probably playing a role. And it's how we influence that whole microbial population. And even with one probiotic culture that you add to the livestock diet, and in the context of that whole gastrointestinal tract, shifting that microbial population to one where maybe some more friendly personalities might be there in the context of some of the baddies, really maybe what we should be thinking about with some of our strategies for direct-fed microbial selection and administration in our livestock diets. So in conclusion, again, what I was hoping we'd get to is strategic application of appropriate direct-fed microbials can positively impact neonatal development and production efficiency. So we improved litter performance. We definitely had an impact on neonatal microbial development very early in that young pig's life and also its immune development. And then also, though, we can really think about important strategic selection and application of TFMs for later production stages. So not only doesn't have to be administered early, although I'm certainly an advocate of that, I think the earlier you get it in, the better you're going to have a chance of influencing that microbial population. But you can still select strategic microorganisms to have specific effects on production parameters of interest. And then really what our goal is to dictate a portion of that microbial consortia to exert really a strategic outcome. And with that, I thank you for your attention in the late afternoon. And if we have questions, feeding spores. Oh, the question was, he asked if we were feeding a spore or a vegetative state when we're feeding the bacillus. And we are feeding spores. Because of the stability aspect of spores. The vegetative, of course, we'd have major stability issues with putting in a pelleted feed. And the question was, what species of bacillus were we using? And that's there are two distinct Bacillus subtilis strains. the question was a question about variability of individual animals as far as their microbial populations go. And that's a good question. I was actually here for an informal nutrition symposium on Sunday, and that question was brought up. And from our data, there are certainly going to be similarities with the individual animals, but it's a biological system. It's highly variable. It's something that we struggle with. In general, though, you can see differences, and if you have enough replication, you can pick those differences up of changes that you've elicited with treatment, if that's an antibiotic treatment, if that's a probiotic treatment. But within those individual animals, there's some variation there. So they're certainly not homogenous completely. Question was, is the higher propionate in the rumen translates to different flavor in milk? I have no idea. We didn't look at that I know of. And I was not part of that study, so I can't say that I sampled any milk. So I honestly don't know that that's been looked at. That's a good question. I have a good question. We did not. We didn't in that study. So the question was if we followed the body weight in those pigs after weaning, and we really didn't look at performance post-weaning and see what kind of effect that may have had post-weaning. It's something that really needs to be done. That's a good question. That's correct. The question was about the selection of the Propionibacterium strain and the ones that failed our selection procedure. They would have had a similar effect of increase in ruminal propionate. Unfortunately, I'm pretty sure that the failures never move forward. There's certainly a financial cost to getting these scaled up from fermentation. Space and time and resources to test these in the animal, so I'm fairly certain that the failures would not have moved forward. But I didn't do that work. Sandra, you have a comment on that? Sandra might have actually been involved in some of that. Within a group. The question was if those correlations have been done between like a group of pigs or a group of animals that were high performing, high growth versus low growth, and which ones would be associated with one or the other. And I kind of gave a little teaser. We've actually done a little bit of that work. And if I'm not mistaken, some of the outcomes of that is getting ready to just be published in Livestock Science as part of a digestive physiology of pigs meeting that's held in Spain last year. Where we've actually done a study looking at high-performing pigs and low-performing pigs using the segregated early weaning versus conventional weaning model, as well as an indoor-outdoor reared or farrowed pig model, and looking at the differences in performance in the nursery of those pigs. And that data I teased you with in the beginning of the introduction, with the correlations of those immune profiles to body weight of the pig at 11 days. We've also got immune profiles that would be correlated to those lower performing pigs. And what it ends up being is in the higher performing pigs, this is a generalization, is activation at the level of the gastrointestinal tract seemed to be correlated to high performing pigs. But if you looked at those the immune profiles systemically, they were really what we would deem very quiet, not a lot of differences and not a lot of what we would consider activated populations systemically. But it would be the opposite in the low performing pigs, where now the activation markers are all present in systemic circulation of the low performing pigs, but there really wasn't a lot of activation at the level of the gastrointestinal tract. And that's kind of interesting because it goes along with that premise of inflammation at the level of the gastrointestinal tract is needed for regulation of inflammation. And if that really goes systemic, activation systemically seems to be the drag on animal performance.
Well, that concludes the symposium, but as I indicated at the beginning, I would ask the speakers, if they can, to stick around for a few minutes at least and have an open forum for questions, if there are any. Otherwise, I'm sure we'll all find our way to dinner.